Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and today we're going to do Part 3, Chapter 14, New York, 1969, of Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones of South Bend, Indiana, published back in 2000, I believe it was, yes. This is a very brief chapter, so probably won't even take half an hour. But as I've said, I'm going to go a chapter at a time until we get to the end. They're mostly short as we do the last 100 pages. Find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also at alexlinder.com when it's eventually archived. So, part 3, chapter 14, pages 507 to 513. New York, 1969. And we know that this is his way of doing things. It's sort of biopsy, time, a place, and often one person or two to sort of sketch out a scene by looking at the key players and what they said about it. By the late 1960s, Jack Kerouac was famous as the founder of a movement which he felt had become increasingly alien to what he believed. Whenever he would tell people that Mike Wallace, that BEAT was short for beatific, an incredulous or embarrassed silence would ensue, and the subject would get changed. During the fall of 68, Kerouac was invited to pontificate on the then-emerging hippie movement by William F. Buckley, the conservative icon, on his show, The Firing Line. The hippies, Kerouac opined while sipping scotch from a coffee mug, were apparently some kind of Dionysian movement, moving effortlessly, if incoherently, from defending the hippies as good kids. Kerouac launched into an attack on fellow beatnik Lawrence Ferlinghetti for perverting what Kerouac saw as an essentially Catholic and beatific into, quote, the beat mutiny, the beat insurrection, words I never use, being a Catholic. Kerouac was becoming increasingly alienated from the movement he had been used to launch with his On the Road. His piety may have increased, but his drinking increased along with it, making the piety seem incongruent at best and ludicrous at worst. Before long, drinking would take its toll. On October 20, 1969, Kerouac began hemorrhaging at his Florida home from varicose veins in the esophagus, the result of years of heavy drinking. In the middle of the night, his mother took him to St. Anthony's Hospital, where he died the classic alcoholic's death at 5:30 a.m. on October 21, 1969. Just before appearing on Firing Line, on the way up to the studio in the elevator, Kerouac spoke briefly with Ed Sanders, one of the founding members of a New York band known as the Fugs, who wanted to tell Kerouac how much his writing and life had inspired him. Kerouac's response was short and to the point. "Get the fuck off my back, kid," he said. At around the same time that Kerouac made his last TV appearance, another member of the Fugs by the name of Tuli Kupferberg met a Yugoslavian filmmaker by the name of Dusan Makavejev. Makavejev was in New York because he had just got a grant from the Ford Foundation. After meeting Kupferberg and his friends, Makavejev got an idea for a film, a documentary of the sort that would have redeeming social value, which is to say a film with a lot of naked women engaged in sexual activity. And that was the Supreme Court term that was used to separate art from pornography or obscenity. I know it when I see it. That was banned at that point. It was much, much more restricted before this period, and it's just going into the huge change, the 60s, early 70s. All the laws changed then that changed the culture and changed the politics. It would be a film on Wilhelm Reich because New York was the center of the cultural world just then, and in the center of the world, this world, Wilhelm Reich was making a comeback. Reich had died in prison in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania in 1959 after being convicted of selling Orgon boxes to the FDA. He died convinced that President Eisenhower was sending Air Force planes to watch over him and still hoping that he would get a grant for his work on Orgon energy from the Rockefellers. Misspelled. There's no R in it. Second R. The Reich who came back from the dead 10 years later was a reincarnation not of the man who sold Orgon boxes and supported President Eisenhower. The Reich who came back from the dead was the man who did Sexpol work in Berlin in 1930. Magnus Hirschfeld and such. By the time Reich had been rediscovered by the New Left in 1969, he had been dead for 10 years, But that fact was irrelevant because the Reich the cultural revolutionaries were interested in promoting had stopped writing in 1933 anyway. On January 4, 1971, Christopher Lehman Haupt wrote a review of the new Farrar Straus edition of The Mass Psychology of Fascism, which announced in effect that the Reich revival had begun in earnest. So Christopher Lehman Haupt writes in 71 a review of The Mass Psychology of Fascism, which is Reich's book from the 30s, sparking a Reich revival. Wilhelm Reich, Lehman Haupt proclaimed, the Austrian sexologist and inventor of the so-called Orgon, O-R-G-O-N-E, energy accumulator, has made a comeback. Reich, according to the review, was the father of youth culture, the sexual revolution, and the feminist movement. Kate Millett's book, Sexual Politics, was written under his influence. Beyond that, Reich was better at reconciling Freud and Marx than Marcuse, especially by expounding his, quote, credo that sexual man was liberated from his need for authority, religion, and marriage. Reich, in other words, makes considerable sense, at least to someone sympathetic to the goal of sexual liberation. Lehman Haupt was, in fact, so enamored of Reich's vision of sexual liberation, he was even willing to take a second look at his theory of orgone energy. Perhaps it's time to reconsider all of Wilhelm Reich, he concluded. 4 months later, on April 18, 1971, the New York Times returned to Reich, this time devoting a feature-length article in their Sunday magazine to his thought. In Wilhelm Reich, The Psychiatrist is Revolutionary, David Elkind described how student communards in Berlin pelted the police with softbound copies of Reich's The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Was it compassion or frugality that kept them from using hardbound copies? Reich, quote, was being resurrected everywhere in Europe as a hero saint to students demanding social reform, and now many American young people were now discovering that Reich is very much their kind of revolutionary, too. This was the case because his message was more appealing to the American left, who felt that they could bring down the state by sexual license without the sublimation urged by Freud or the political revolution urged by Marx. Over the summer of 1971, Dusan Makhachev released the film he had begun while in the United States on a grant from the Ford Foundation called W.R., Mysteries of the Organism. Like I Am Curious, Yellow, it juxtaposed pornography with political harangue, thereby assuring the viewer that it had redeeming social merit and would escape obscenity prosecution. The film also showed footage of Thule Kupferberg stalking people on the streets of New York City, wearing an army helmet and carrying a toy M16. The political message was unmistakable. The new left was going to repudiate both Stalin and U.S. imperialism in a mystical convergence based on shared indulgence in sexual appetite. It was like make love, not war, or some more prolix version of the same thing, all traceable, according to Makhachev, to Reich's influence. He was a kind of prophet of a new time, Makhachev told Film Quarterly in their winter 1971 issue. He started the Sexpol movement in Germany. In 1930, they had about 30,000 members and organized lectures all over Germany. Reich's ideal was that the Communist Party should organize youth around dance halls, not to get young people to dull political lectures, to find young people where they are. Which meant, of course, says Jones, encouraging masturbation. Sex economic clinical experience teaches us, Reich wrote in the 30s, that those who never had the courage to masturbate have the most unfavorable prognosis. Sexual feelings have been suppressed, perhaps even for a while successfully. The sexual apparatus has not been used. And then when authoritarian society finally permits gratification, the apparatus fails. It has become rusty. The American revolutionaries were now busy making sure that their apparatus, quote-unquote, didn't become, quote-unquote, rusty by finally summoning, if not the will to bring down the state, then certainly the courage to masturbate. Makhachev devoted a good deal of his film to the work of Betty Dodson, the well-known drawer of erotic drawings and painter of erotic paintings, whose specialty was teaching young women how to masturbate because it made women feel, you know, very liberated. To give some sense of historical continuity under Reich's influence, the dates Berlin, May 1, 1931, Belgrade, May 1, 1971, flash on the screen, and then Betty Dodson comes on and talks about how a woman who was in this women's lib group together, it's a consciousness-raising group, really had no masturbatory experience or background. She was in her early 30s. She didn't masturbate. She was totally dependent on a man, a partner, to make orgasm, which is a lousy posture to be. And she started to practice masturbation, and she was amazed at some of the things that happened to her. And her orgasm became much more intense. In case his readers hadn't seen the film, David Elkin made the same point in his New York Times article. Reich noted, he tells us, that whenever the patient reported that he had masturbated with complete satisfaction, that his symptoms lessened. Reich proceeded to analyze the patient's guilt over masturbation. When this chronic guilt was alleviated and the patient could masturbate regularly with complete gratification, his symptoms subsided to the extent that he could work and socialize to a degree not possible for him before. The film, of course, devoted its sexual footage to showing the well-endowed Malina, M-I-L-E-N-A, having sex with soldiers, and then declaiming Reichian mumbo-jumbo like, "Body tissue deprived of life energy turns cancerous. Cancer is the hysteria of cells condemned to death. Cancer and fascism are closely related." So if you have sex and masturbate all the time, your cells don't die of cancer and your mind doesn't turn to fascism. Footage of masturbation, it turns out, is not as stimulating as real sexual activity. With Makhachev's film, the Reich boom reached its high watermark. The techniques of manipulation that Reich's character analysis enabled continued to be refined in places like Esalen by people like Fritz Perls, and would get applied in unlikely places like seminaries for religious. Perls learned about Reich through Paul Goodman, and together they created what came to be known as Gestalt therapy, which was Reich's theories, especially those involving body armor, in quotes, in action. Michael Weber argues that Reich's theories via Perls' Gestalt therapy eventually became a covert form of social control that wrought serious damage in religious orders in Germany, sort of like what we heard about in the U.S. last recording segment, just as Reich said they would. So preach masturbation and destroy the religious orders and destroy the self-control of the people, prevent them from becoming fascist and open society to Jewish nation wreckers is what's going on here. They also made destructive inroads in American corporate and academic life, where icebreaking exercises like blind milling became part of the repertoire of psychic manipulation. Liberation from repression had become a powerful tool for social control, both in small groups and in the mass media. Elizabeth Wurtzel never mentions Reich in Bitch, her 90s memoir, but she mentions feminism, which was, as Kate Millett's book made clear, exoteric Reichianism. The consciousness-raising sessions of the 70s were, as Makhachev said, direct descendants of Reich's sexpal work in the 30s. Wurtzel does, however, talk extensively about using sex as a form of social control, something which she calls, in her inimitable way, pussy power. Delilah, she tells us, had the right idea. Delilah embodies the failure of this male prerogative when it comes to regulating human emotions. Samson and Delilah, quote, offer the first example, according to Wurtzel, of what we now call sexual politics. Samson is unbeatable militarily, a discovery the Philistines make to their chagrin, but through his infatuation with Delilah, he becomes, quote, enslaved to his dick, unquote, and as a result, easily defeated. Sex is a form of political control. This is the lesson that Israel learned from Samson's demise, and indeed they learned it throughout the Bible, usually the hard way, which is to say, by being punished by military defeat after falling into idolatry, which was an excuse for illicit sexual activity. Wurtzel is onto something here. Or is she? No sooner does she praise Delilah as a precursor to all the strong, modern, willful women, women who do just what they want, the kind of woman, in other words, which Wurtzel aspires to be, then she is full of ambivalence about the object of her praise. Wurtzel admires women who use sex as a weapon, and she especially admires the character Madonna plays in Body of Evidence because, quote, she kills with her pussy, but at the same time, she is full of misgivings when she tries to apply this lesson to her own life. Once again, the issue comes down to the relationship between power and control, between reason and appetite. Do those who capitulate to their desires control them, or are they controlled by them? I am completely free, Miss Wurzel tells us. And as far as my life goes, I have all the power. In fact, I've turned 30 in an era when, for the first time in history, a woman can feel as unencumbered and unbound as I do. And yet, for all the power I command in not being some man's dependent appendage, I generally walk around through life feeling pretty powerless. As with most feminists, Wurzel has difficulty reading her own text. Yeah, I think that applies to Jones, too. Delilah, as in our own day, when her spiritual descendants write stroke books for chicks, is an agent of the priests of Dagon. Delilah doesn't control the power she wields any more than Wurzel does. The power controls her. Hence, Wurzel's sense of powerlessness even after the liberation from repression occurs, or better said, especially after the liberation from oppression occurs. The only power Wurzel retains unequivocally is the power to mess up her own life, a power which she has evidently exercised repeatedly. When I have a man in front of me, she tells us, even one I really like, even one who is quite literally putty in my hands and whatever else, I feel the incredible urge to use the power he has given me to ruin his life. And her own, one might add, because the only way one finds fulfillment in life is by sharing it with someone else, by, in effect, giving that life over to someone else and having the other person do the same thing. That mutual giving is the essence of sexuality. Masturbation is the most basic violation of that truth. Using masturbation or any other form of sexual vice as liberation from repression is like using suicide as the antidote to murder. No one else can kill you because you killed yourself. In triumphing over repression, you have defeated yourself by enslaving yourself in the name of liberation. So, again, in triumphing over repression via masturbation and promiscuous sex, you have defeated yourself by enslaving yourself to your appetites in the name of liberation. So always calling things the opposite of what it actually is the Jewish technique. Now, he's not talking about Jews through all this, but all these people are Jews, Wurzel and Reich and Perls and the rest of them. Wurzel is not alone in learning the truth the hard way. Reich learned the same lesson in a slightly more complicated fashion. On January 5, 1951, Reich unsheathed a gram of radium in his laboratory at Organon in Rangeley, Maine, thereby contaminating the entire area and exposing everyone there to radiation sickness. He thought that organ energy would counteract the effect of nuclear energy, but it turns out that the opposite was true. In the final analysis, though, his Oranur experiments were nowhere near as toxic as his sexual experimentation. In both instances, he tried to control one of the primal forces of nature, and in both instances, the forces ended up controlling him. By the late 70s, the Reich boom was over. Looking at the dawn of the Reagan era a little bit like the leisure suit gathering dust at the back of the closet. The left might say, and indeed it has said, that Reagan was the tyrannical reaction to the excesses of the sexual revolution, but they still seem incapable of accepting the rationale adumbrated in Plato, which would explain the change. The real reaction, however, wasn't political, it was cultural and inchoate. That means imperfectly formed, sort of new and unhazy. Sex led to horror. Alien was the sequel to Deep Throat. By 1979, no one thought oral sex was fun anymore. That might be a bit of an overstatement there, buddy. The ladies testifying at the Mies Commission made that point unmistakably clear. Katie Royfe remembers the same era, feeling the general atmosphere of anxiety and apprehension, even though there was no biological threat to which we could attach our vague premonitions of disaster. No herpes, no AIDS. The diseases were, in retrospect, the least horrific of the sequelae flowing from the quote, liberation from repression that was the sexual revolution. The real source of horror was the release of appetite from rational control and what that did to otherwise normal human beings. In seeking liberation from repression, That is essentially denying that there is a need or is such a thing as self-control or a need for self-control. By denying that and seeking liberation from repression, as they always put it, that's why it isn't in quotes, the culture discovered that the punishment fit the crime in an uncanny way. In fact, the punishment was the crime. Liberation was slavery at best. More often than not, it was death, too. I remember Katie Royfe wrote that another Jew, feminist, daughter of a famous feminist, I remember Katie Royfe wrote in her memoir of the time, Last Night in Paradise, taking a bright yellow paperback of Looking for Mr. Goodbar from my parents' bookshelf and reading it more than once. I remember being haunted by the image of this naked woman bleeding to death on her bed. I remember also the image of her sitting in the bar, sipping her white wine, pretending to read a book and waiting to pick up a strange man, an image strangely shadowed by my knowledge of what was going to happen to her. Her death seemed somehow natural for an act of random violence. It also seemed to hold some implications about my own life, about the men, bars, wine, and strangers in my future, that I only dimly understood. I wouldn't have been able to explain the danger I felt, curled up on my parents' chintz couch, reading the cheap paperback, but I felt it nonetheless. Along with Alien, and remember, Jones has written a book about horror movies that talks about this theme, that they're about the effects of sexual liberation. Along with Alien, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which was made into a film in 1978, was one of the seminal events of the late 70s when sex turned into horror on a pan-cultural basis. Royfe might have understood the trajectory better if she read Plato's Republic, but a school system which promotes masturbation is not going to waste its time undermining its efforts to enslave its students by teaching Plato. Eric Vogelin, who has read Plato, thinks that his description of the transmission from the democratic to the despotic soul well may be considered the masterpiece of Platonic psychology. This is Vogelin. In the democratic state of the soul, all appetites are on the same footing and compete with one another for satisfaction. This state of amiable and perhaps aesthetic rottenness, however, exhausts itself, and now the last abyss of depravity opens. For beyond the ordinary luxuriance of desires lie the ultimate lusts, which stir in a soul in its dreams, but ordinarily kept down by the controls of wisdom and law, external and internal controls. In dreams, the beast goes on its rampage of murder, incest, and perversions. Jones again. The trajectory is nonetheless clear. The democratic soul, which frees itself from all restraint in pursuit of sexual gratification, is followed by the tyrannical soul, which brings horror and perversion, which etymologically means denial of truth. Quote, the decomposition of the well-ordered soul, according to Vogelin, leads not to disorder or confusion, but to a perverted order. It seems that Plato was acutely aware of the spirituality of evil and of the fascination emanating from a tyrannical order. The tyrant is addiction in a metaphorical sense. In other words, passions which demand to be satisfied and command the rational being who should control them to do their bidding. But the tyrant can also be construed in a very literal sense as the man who rules over the people who are corrupted by their passions through the agency of those very passions. The man who is controlled by his appetite is also controlled by the man who controls his appetite for him. In general, we think of the age of tyranny as short-lived, and we think of the tyrants that way too. Robespierre, Hitler, Stalin all presided over the despotic reaction to democracy run amok. Stalin's reign, however, could hardly be considered brief in human terms, and with him we begin to discern a more disconcerting possibility. What if someone were smart enough to maintain the perverted order indefinitely? The first principle to be recognized is that sexual life is not a private affair, Reich tells us. The sexual, quote from Reich, the sexual restructuring of man for the establishment of the capacity for full sexual pleasure cannot be left to individual initiative, but is a cardinal problem of all social science. The whole population must acquire the secure feeling that the revolutionary leadership is doing everything it can to guarantee sexual pleasure without reservation, without any ifs and buts. And we see the modern push from homosexuals last 20 years too. They get marriage and then they start pushing transgenderism. They even just started to promote pedophilia, as I read this to you, in 2017. They've done that in 2015 and 16. They slowed up to attack Milo Yiannopoulos hypocritically as a pedophile, but then they'll pick it up again in a few more months. There's no natural end to it, really. If just do what you want, do what feels good, well, you know, there's all kinds of weirdos out there, necrophiliacs and pedophiles and homosexuals, and you keep promoting that, keep promoting the looseness, and yeah, it'll end up in some kind of a strong reaction. The real question, as we do the last paragraph of the chapter, the real question, the one posed by Aldous Huxley, is whether the regime in which, quote, normality is redefined as perversion and perversion as normality will get clever enough to refine the techniques of servitude to become so pleasurable that no one notices the horror anymore or has the will to object. So that's about the revival of Reich, that chapter, brief chapter, part 3, chapter 14, New York, 1969. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up more Libido Dominandi.